And it was by faith that he knew that for however destitute this slave was, that he was a member of a people who had something greater, far greater than they could ever get by being in the palace of Pharaoh. They had the promises of the true and living God.
Hi, I'm Phil Gross. Welcome to In the Light, a sermon series by Pastor Andrew Shepp of the Reformed Presbyterian Church. This sermon is the 18th in a series on the book of Hebrews, and will focus on chapter 11, verses 23 to 26. We pray that this message of God's faithfulness to Moses will encourage and strengthen your walk with Christ.
If you looked back on your former self 10 years ago, if you met your former self, or 20 years ago, or 30, it all depends on how old you are and how far you can go back. Would your former self be surprised when he or she saw you now, and where you are, and what you were doing, and what you were like? Or would it make perfect sense? How many of you had planned way back to be doing what you're doing, to live where you're living, to be the kind of person you are? Those of you who are old enough and you graduated from high school and you were in a yearbook and you were voted the person most likely to fill in the blank, did that come true? Now let's project ourselves into the future and let's say hello to our future selves. 10 years from now, what do you look like? Where are you? What are you doing? Do you know? Do you have a guess? Does the thought fill you with fear or excitement? Does it depress you, or does it encourage you? Well, the reality is we know very little about what's going to happen to us in 10, 20, 30 years. And probably we didn't know 10, 20, or 30 years back that we would be who we are, where we are, doing what we're doing today. Life's like that, and we in Christ who walk by faith are in for anything. We recognize we're not in control of our lives, but faith tells us and assures us that we know that one who is trustworthy is in control of our lives. He's leading us here and there, and that life is a journey. Well, today we come to Moses as this writer is addressing a group of Jewish Christians who are fearful of the future. They've suffered, they've been persecuted, they've lost a lot, they've sacrificed a lot, they've been excluded and ostracized. And their faith, which had been frayed down to a thin string by which they were clinging to the promises of God, was being sorely tested. And the writer is encouraging them, pointing them to stories that they had known about, growing up hearing about in synagogue and in their Jewish homes, of the great men and women of the Old Testament who, like them, walked by faith, who were in the same place they were at one point in their lives, of having to cling to something you don't see, of not being distracted or fooled by what you do see, realizing that it's temporary, and realizing that it was what's of eternal significance and truth to you is what God has promised, whatever is going on in the present moment. And that's how you live your life, trusting what He has promised and therefore following Him. And he comes to Moses. We know Moses as the great hero of the founding of the nation of Israel, as the one who confronted the great tyrant, Pharaoh, and demanded that he release 2 million of his slaves. And wonder of wonders, he does. And they become a nation, led by Moses miraculously through a sea, walking on dry land, through the wilderness for 40 years. And Moses leaves them at the age of 120 on the brink of entering the promised land, the land that Abraham had seen, the land that Isaac had seen and Jacob had left. So Moses is this great towering figure. And that stuff of Moses' career, his leadership in the birth of the nation, this was a segment of life that began when he was 80 years old. The last 40 years of his life. Moses lives 120 years, and his life is divisible by clean and neat 40-year segments, three of them. Not many of us can say that about our own lives. I want us to meet this man, Moses. The stuff that he's famous for, being the mediator of his people, the go-between between God and the nation of Israel, as he leads them through the desert and out of Egypt and to the borders of the promised land, that's covered by the book of Hebrews in the next few verses that we'll look at next week, Lord willing. But there's a background to that. When Moses encounters the living God who speaks to him from a burning bush and calls him to do this great work and to face this mighty oppressor, Pharaoh, at the age of 80, that's where his career really gets going, where he finds his life's calling. Not many of us can say that either. But there's a background to that. There's an explanation of why this man was willing to follow God in doing that. And I want us to meet Moses before this great initiation of his career at the age of 80, just before he meets God and hears him in the burning bush. As a 79-year-old, if you will, he's a shepherd. He's been doing this, it would appear, forever, although he's only been at it really for about 40 years. He lives in the wilderness among a nomadic people. He wears the clothes of the rough clothing of a shepherd, of impoverished subsistence people. He's a Midianite. He has a wife, a Midianite wife, a child. He lives with his wife's family there in the wilderness, taking care of sheep. Weather-beaten face. Can you see him? And it's been this way since the age of 40. And now he's coming on 80. Pretty well-established routine. And yet he's about to do this incredible work. And to understand why this man was called to that, you have to go back in time, further. Who would know, seeing this shepherd, that 40 years ago, he was a very different person indeed? He was not wearing the rough clothing of a shepherd. He was not dwelling out in the wilderness taking care of sheep. 40 years earlier, at the age of 40, Moses was wearing the fine linens of a palace dweller in the mightiest, greatest, most powerful, and wealthiest kingdom on the face of the earth, Egypt. And he was there as one in line to inherit the throne, the son of the king's daughter, a high-ranking member of the ruling class. He lived in what counted for the height of luxury in his day. He had the best kind of food that was available, servants to serve his every need. He had wealth beyond measure. His life was a life of leisure, chariot racing, authority, power, wealth. It was all his, with a great future ahead of him. Around that palace, you could see a bustling economy, great buildings going up. If you went to Shanghai today, you would see high-rises going up every day because things are booming there. But that was the Egypt of his day. Construction projects all over the place that are being driven by at least 2 million slaves. Over 600,000 male Hebrews over the age of 20 building these great buildings and these great projects for this mighty power. altogether different man than the 80-year-old shepherd in the wilderness, or so it would appear. But you see this man acting strangely. You see this man one day walking away from the palace, not on official business, not with his entourage, but sneaking off on his own and wandering down to one of the construction sites where the buildings are being built, where the slaves are hard at work. Now understand that this leader in Egypt lived before the days of modern democracy and before the election campaigns and the photo opportunities that politicians engage in when they, with their entourage, go to some factory and put on a hard hat so that they have a photo opportunity to be seen meeting average Joes. This was not modern America. This was ancient Egypt. He did not need the votes of anyone to put him into power. He had power, and he retained that power by oppressing and subjugating the average Joe. He is there not on official business to see how the work is going. There's something else that's driving his curiosity. He spends time zeroing in on one humble slave at his work. And what he witnesses is, I'm sure, something that was routine, everyday, commonplace. The enforcement of royal policy. The beating of a slave by his Egyptian foreman at the construction zone. That's how they made sure that these people stayed subjugated, kept doing their work, kept working as hard as they could, through terror, through brutality. And one, if we were, if we didn't know the story already, in our imagination showing up and observing this royal figure in his fine linens, watching what's going on here, what we would expect is this man to perhaps, if anything, react by commending the Egyptian foreman for so faithfully carrying out the policies of his government in oppressing the Hebrew slave. But instead, as you know from our reading, he does something, he reacts in an altogether different way. And when he thinks no one's looking, he goes and he takes the Egyptian and slays him and buries his body in the sand. But it becomes known. In that one act, what Moses does is he crosses a line and he burns a bridge behind him. He makes a decision, he makes a choice. And it's an amazing choice that's difficult for us to wrap our minds around, because in that one act, what he does is he identifies himself not with the people of privilege among whom he travels and moves, but with the oppressed slave population of the Hebrews. And by doing what he did, he once for all cuts the line and says goodbye to all of the wealth and the power and the privilege that he knows and enjoys. And the grand future that might have been his as one standing in line to inherit the throne. With that one act, he turns his back on that, on everything that his eyes can see, and throws his lot in with someone who has nothing, someone who's downtrodden, the slave. Does that kind of make you wonder? Does that strike you as strange, as an amazing thing? We're told that he did that by faith. By faith, he was able to look beyond what the eyes saw. By faith, he was able to interpret what his eyes saw. And by faith, he was able to say that all of the wealth and power that he enjoyed and could enjoy more of in the future in Egypt was pleasure, as the writer to Hebrews says, but was the pleasure of sin. It was all based on the idol worship of paganism. It was all based on the brutality of oppression and slavery. as great as it was, and as mighty as those buildings are, some of which stand still today in the desert, it wouldn't last. And it was by faith that he knew that for however destitute the slave was, that he was a member of a people who had something greater, far greater than they could ever get by being in the palace of Pharaoh. They had the promises of the true and living God, and they stood to inherit something eternal and lasting and wonderful. It was by faith that he knew that. Now that begs the question, well, how did he get that faith? And for that, we have to step a little farther back in time and go back another full 40 years and meet Moses now as an infant and meet his parents. Amram was his father, and Yochaved was his mother. And they were Hebrew slaves. They had two kids, Aaron, boy, Miriam, girl. And when Pharaoh is making his second attempt at population control among this burgeoning peoples of the Hebrews, the first attempt not working because of the heroism of the midwives. These two are who are commended in the first chapter of Exodus. Now, these people have been for a couple of centuries in subjugation to the Egyptians, in slavery. They've lost immediate contact with the God of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What happened to him? He hasn't spoken to them for centuries. And to some degree, they've really lost their way. And we know that the light of faith has not been burning really strongly among the Hebrews, even though God is blessing them and has a plan for their future. Because later on, when Moses does meet God in the burning bush, and he's told to go and talk to the elders of the Israelites in Egypt, he wants God to know what his name is. He wants to know from God what his name is so that he can tell the elders who are going to ask, well, which God is it that sent you? Because they had become familiar down through the ages with the God of the Nile, the sun god, the moon god, the god of the gods of the Egyptians. Which god is Moses representing? We know later on from the children of Israel and their behavior in the wilderness as they worship the golden calf that they had imbibed some of the paganism, the idolatry of Egypt, that the faith in the promises of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had not been strong and robust, but it was still there. It was still there among certain heroes, these midwives who feared God. This woman, Yochaved, whose name is the Lord is Glory. And here, Pharaoh's second attempt at population control among the Hebrews, the first one having failed, is that you should throw your baby boys in the Nile River. Well, the baby's born, and Yochaved notices that there's something extraordinary about this baby. The Bible says in Exodus and again in Hebrews and in Stephen's speech about it in the book of Acts, all refers to this, that he was beautiful. He was a beautiful baby. Now, we've all seen beautiful babies. They're usually our own. We've also seen ugly babies. They always belong to other people. You've heard the joke that you're so ugly that when you were born, the doctor slapped your mother. Let's be honest. There are ugly babies. Let's be honest, on the other hand, that it's a good thing when a little baby is crying and screaming and waking you up in the middle of the night that they are so cute. It's God's provision for their survival, right? Some of us have been there. But this baby's really beautiful. How different history would have been if Moses was an ugly baby? Think about that. I mean, God uses means that are shaped and designed for us where we are. He uses bread and grape juice to remind us, oh yeah, Jesus died for me. He uses the beauty of a little baby to trigger something in a mother. That's natural on the one hand, you know. Your baby is the most beautiful that's ever been born in the history of mankind. But there's something beyond the natural in this case. There's something extraordinary about this child. There's something extraordinary that drives this woman to do something utterly heroic. And we're told that it's not done because of just her natural affection for her child. What she does is she hides Moses for 3 months. What does that mean? I want you now in your imagination to transport yourself into Nazi Germany or some horrific moment in history like that, where you hear the marching of the soldiers and the Gestapo's, boot sounds. Thank you, boot steps, that'll work. Approaching your door. And in this case, it is the soldiers of Egypt, and they are looking for the enforcement of the latest edict of the king that the baby boys get thrown into the Nile River. They're looking for baby boys. They're searching the homes. How often did they come by Hevet's home? Daily, every other day, every week, whatever it was a terrifying thing, and it was an act of immense bravery on her part, because she not only had the natural affection she had for this child, but she had to weigh her desire to preserve her baby against the risk that she was putting herself, her husband, her two other children, Miriam and Aaron, in by defying the king's edict. And we're told it went beyond natural affection. It was by faith that she did this. By faith. Down through the generations, God had faithfully preserved a witness to his promises, and she clung to those promises. And when she saw the extraordinary appearance of this boy, it put her in mind of the promises of God that he is going to make things very different from the current status quo. We read in the book of Hebrews that when Moses, 40 years later, as a 40-year-old, wealthy, powerful man in Egypt, made that choice, crossed that line and burned the bridge, and identified himself with the poor and the oppressed, that he turned his back on the pleasures of sin, which were temporary, and he embraced the reproach of Christ. That's not just some broad, vague faith in a good future, that things will work out. That's a very specific, detailed faith in a promise. In other words, he did it for Jesus. Why? Because he was taught by his mother. Now, the wonderful story of the providence of God. And this woman keeps this child hidden for 3 months, believing. She's been taught that our first parents, Adam and Eve, were told that the seed of the woman, one day, the descendant of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. However terrifying that serpent was, and now in Pharaoh and in Egypt, the serpent was terrifying, but there was a promise that she believed. She saw this child and thought, I don't know how certain she was of it, but God's going to send a deliverer. God's going to send someone to crush the serpent. And she knew that her forefather Abraham had been promised by God that through his seed, through his descendant, there was a descendant to come through whom all the families of the earth would be blessed. There would be someone coming to deliver and turn the curse around. It was coming. She believed it. Here she was, the product of centuries, enslaved in Egypt, hopeless, no future, naturally speaking, but she believed the promise. And she hid this boy at great personal risk for 3 months, until it was hard to hide him. He was too noisy and becoming too active when the soldiers came by, when they broke in the door. Where could she keep a 3, a 4, a 5-month-old? So what she does is she puts him in the river. Isn't that interesting? She puts her baby boy in the Nile. But she remembers something else from her people's past, from the promises of God, from the covenant down through the ages. She remembers how God preserved someone else through the waters, Noah and his family. And so what she does is she builds for this little baby boy his own miniature ark, covers it with tar and pitch, just like the big one that Noah built, trusting that God would preserve a people until it was time, until in the fullness of time, and ends up being, you know, a millennium and a half later, until that descendant would come, that deliverer would come. But here he was in sort of a preview form in Moses, this extraordinary child. And you know, the discovery of Moses by Pharaoh's daughter, his crying, her pity, the way that God worked all of that out in his providential commitment to his promises. I mean, can you relate to these things in your own life as you think, wow, the coincidences of the things that have just fallen in place and come together, and who could ever have planned it this way but Almighty God, that we would be preserved, that his promise would be kept despite almost being extinguished and destroyed and us being thrown into utter hopelessness. He preserves his promise. He preserves Moses. And wonder of wonders, Miriam's there following, making sure the baby's okay. And she's got the sort of the instinct of a child who, through oppression, has had to grow up too fast and is very savvy and smart. And with her mother, they've strategized, and she's ready when Pharaoh's daughter picks up the baby to offer her mother as someone who can nurse the baby and take care of the baby. And so, not only does Moses' mother, Yochaved, get to keep her baby boy alive, but she gets paid to take care of him until the point when he can, a little more grown up, and weaning came much later than it does nowadays. So she had time with Moses before he went to the palace. And during that time, she not only nursed this baby boy physically, she fed him the promises of God. And in that humble way, this humble slave woman was sowing the seeds that would bring down an empire by faith. Isn't that awesome? What does it mean for you and me? Well, it points us to Jesus. Jesus enjoyed the palace of heaven and all the privileges, the wealth, the power that came with it. But Jesus crossed a line at one point and saw that his equality with God is not something that he was going to cling to, but he emptied himself. And he identified himself with the oppressed, with the enslaved. He heard their cries and their moans. He heard you and me. He left his palace one day and he found you and he watched you. And then he took down your enemy because he attached himself in his heart to you. How was it that at the age of 80, Moses was called to go back to Egypt and in that rough shepherd's clothing to return to the place of his youth where he'd spent 40 years, not as an Egyptian, not asking for his job back, but as a Hebrew, confronting Pharaoh, saying, God says, let my people go. Faith. Faith that was passed on down through the generations in the darkest of times. Faith that was taught in whispers into a baby's ear as he grew. We see Jesus, who came down for you and for me to deliver us. We see God's promises fulfilled.
Thank you for listening. In the Light is produced by the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Syracuse, New York. May the peace of God be with you today and always.